reaching across the small table toward me. I stand up and shake his hand, and then the hands of the other two officials. I wonder if they can feel the current of energy that runs through me. The blood in my veins is made of adrenaline and relief.
That was an exceptional demonstration of sorting ability.
Thank you, sir. On their way out the door, he turns back to me one last time and says,
"We have our eyes on you now, young lady."
He shuts the metal door behind him. It makes a thick, solid sound, a sound of finality. As I listen to the nothing that follows, I suddenly realize why Kai likes to blend in. It is a strange feeling, knowing for certain that the officials watch me more closely. It is as though I stood in the way when that door swung shut, and I find myself pinned now by the weight of their observation. A concrete thing, real and heavy. The night of M's match banquet, I go to bed early and fall asleep quickly. It is my night to wear the data tags, and I hope the information they gather from my dreams shows the sleep patterns of a completely normal 17-year-old girl. But in my dream, I'm sorting for the officials again. The screen comes up with M's picture, and I'm supposed to sort her into a matching pool. I freeze. My hands stop. My brain stops.
"Is there a problem?"
the gray-haired official asks. "I can't tell where I should sort her," I say. He looks at M's face on the screen and smiles.
"Ah, that's not a problem. She has your compact, doesn't she?"
"Yes."
"She'll carry her tablets to the banquet in it, as you did. Simply tell her to take the red one, and everything will be fine."
Suddenly, I'm at the banquet, pushing through girls in dresses and boys in suits and parents in plain clothes. I turn them, shove them, do whatever I have to do to see their faces. Because everyone here wears yellow, and it all blurs together. I can't sort. I can't see. I spin another girl around. Not M. I accidentally knock a tray full of cake out of a waiter's hand, trying to catch up to a girl with a graceful walk. The tray falls on the floor and the cake breaks apart, like soil falling from roots. Not M. The crowd thins, and a girl in a yellow dress stands alone in front of a blank screen. M. She's about to cry.
"It's all right,"
I call out to her, pushing my way through more people.
"Take the tablet and everything will be fine."
M's eyes brighten. She pulls out my compact. She lifts the green tablet and puts it in her mouth, fast.
"No!"
I cry out. Too late. She puts the blue tablet in her mouth next.
"Red one!"
I finish, pushing through one last cluster of people to stand in front of her.
"I don't have one,"
she says, turning around, her back toward the screen now. She shows me the open compact empty. Her eyes are sad.
"I don't have a red tablet."
"You can have mine," I say, eager to share with her, eager to help her this time. I won't sit idly by. I pull out my container, twist the top, put the red tablet right into her hand.
"Oh, thank you, Kasia,"
she says. She lifts it to her mouth. I see her swallow. Everyone in the room has stopped milling about. They all look at us, now eyes on M. What will the red tablet do? None of us knows, except me. I smile. I know it will save her. Behind M, the screen flashes on with her match, right in time for him to see M fall down, dead. Her body makes a heavy sound when it falls. In contrast to the lightness of her eyes fluttering shut, of her dress fluttering in folds around her, of her hands fluttering open and closed like the wings of something small. I wake up sweating and freezing at the same time, and it takes me a minute to calm myself down. Even though the officials have laughed at the notion that the red tablet is a death tablet, the rumors still persist. That explains why I dreamed about it killing M. Just because I dreamed it doesn't mean it's true.
The sleep tags feel sticky on my skin, and I wish I didn't have to wear them tonight. At least the nightmare isn't a recurring one, so I can't be accused of obsessing over something. Besides, I don't think they can tell exactly what I dreamed, just that I did. And a teenage girl having an occasional nightmare can't be uncommon. No one will flag that particular piece of data when it loads to my file. But the gray-haired official said that they had their eyes on me. I stare up into the dark with an ache in my chest that makes it hard to breathe, but not hard to think. Ever since the day of Grandfather's final banquet last month, I've gone back and forth between wishing he had never given me that paper and being glad that he did. Because at least I have the words to describe what I feel is happening inside of me. The dying of the light. If I couldn't name it, would I even know what it is? Would I even feel it at all? I pick up the microcard that the official gave me in the green space and tiptoe toward the port. I need to see Xander's face. I need reassurance that everything is in order. I stop short. My mother stands at the port screen talking to someone. Who would contact her so late at night? My father sees me from the front room, where he sits on the divan waiting for my mother to finish. He gestures for me to come in and sit next to him. When I do, he glances at the microcard in my hands and smiles and teases like any father would.
Seeing Xander at school isn't enough? You want to catch another glimpse of him before you go to sleep?
He puts his arm around me and gives me a hug.
I understand. I was the same way with your mother. That was back when they let us print out a picture from the ports right away, instead of making us wait until after our first meeting.
What did your parents think of Mama being a farmlander? My father pauses.
Well, they were both a little concerned, to be honest. They never thought I'd match with someone who didn't live in a city. But it didn't take them long to decide they were happy about it.
He gets that smile on his face. The one he always gets when he talks about falling in love.
It only took that first meeting to change their minds. You should have seen your mother then.
Why did you meet in the city instead of in the farmlands? I ask. Usually it's customary for the first meeting to be held close to the girl's home. There's always an official from the match department present to make sure things go smoothly.
She insisted on coming here, even though it was a long train ride. She wanted to see the city as soon as possible. My parents and the official and I all went to the station to meet her.
He pauses, and I know he is picturing the meeting in his head, imagining my mother stepping off that air train. And? I know I sound impatient, but I have to remind him that he's not back in the past. He's here in the present, and I need to know everything I can about the match that made me.
When she stepped off the train, your grandmother said to me, "She still has the sun on her face."
My father pauses and smiles.
She did, too. I'd never seen anyone look so warm and alive. My parents never voiced a concern about her again. I think we all fell in love with her that day.
Neither of us notice my mother standing in the doorway until she clears her throat.
And I with all of you.
She seems a little sad, and I wonder if she's thinking of grandfather or grandmother or both. She and my father are now the last two people left who remember that day. Except for maybe the official who oversaw their meeting. Who called so late on the port? I asked.
Someone from work,
my mother says, looking weary. She sits down next to my father and leans her head on his shoulder as he puts his arm around her.
I have to leave on a trip tomorrow.
Why? My mother yawns, her blue eyes opening wide. Her face is still sun-kissed from all her work outdoors. She looks a little older than usual, and for the first time, I see a bit of gray interwoven in her thick blonde hair. Some shadows in the sunlight.
It's late, Kasia. You should be asleep. I should be asleep. I'll tell you and Bram all about it in the morning.
I don't protest. I close my hand over the microcard and say, "All right." Before I leave for my room, my mother leans over to give me a kiss goodnight. Once I'm back in my room, I listen through the walls again. Something about my mother leaving right now alarms me. Why now? Where is she going? How long will she be gone? She rarely goes on trips for work.
So?
My father says in the other room. He's trying to keep his voice quiet.
Is everything all right? I can't think of the last time we've had a call so late at night.
I can't tell. Something seems to be going on in another city, but I don't know what it is. They're pulling a few of us from other arboretums to come look at a crop at the arboretum in Grandia. Her voice has the sing-song quality that it gets when it's very late, and she's very tired. I remember it from the nights when she used to tell me those flower stories, and I feel reassured. If she doesn't think something is wrong, then everything must be fine. My mother is one of the smartest people I know.
How long will you be gone?
My father asks. A week at the most. Do you think Kasia and Bram will be all right? It's rather a long trip.
They'll understand.
There's a pause.
Kasia still seems upset about the sample.
I know. I worry about that. My mother sighs a soft sound that somehow I still hear through the wall.
It was an honest mistake. I hope she sees that soon.
Mistake? It wasn't a mistake, I think. And then I realize she doesn't know. He hasn't told her. My father has a secret from my mother. And I have a horrible thought. So their match isn't perfect after all. The moment I think it, I wish it back. If their match isn't perfect, then what are the chances that mine will be? The next morning, another thunderstorm tumbles the leaves on the maple trees and showers rain on the new roses. I'm eating my breakfast, oatmeal again, steaming in its foilware dish, when I hear the port announce,
"Kasia Reyes, your leisure activity, hiking, has been canceled for the day due to inclement weather. Please report to second school for extra study hours instead."
No hiking, which means no Kai. The walk to the air train is a wet one and muggy. The rain adds to the water in the air, trapping the humidity. My coppery hair begins to tangle and curl, as it does sometimes in weather like this. I look up at the sky, but only see the mass of clouds, no break anywhere. No one else is on my air train, not M, not Xander, not Kai. They probably caught other trains, or are still getting ready, but I have a sense of something missed, something missing, someone missing. Maybe it is me. Once I'm at school, I go upstairs to the research library, where there are several ports. I want to find out about Dylan Thomas and Alfred Lord Tennyson, and if they have any poems that did make the selection. I don't think they did, but I have to make sure. My fingers hover over the screen on the port as I hesitate. The fastest way to find out would be to type in their names, but then there would be a record of someone searching for them, and the search could be traced back to me. It's much safer to go through the lists of poets in the 100 Poems database instead. If I'm looking through poet after poet after poet, that will seem more like an assignment for class, and less like a search for something specific. It takes a long time to go through each name, but I finally get to the T's. I find one poem by Tennyson, and I want to read it, but I don't have time. There is no Thomas. There is a Thoreau. I touch that name. One poem of his, The Moon, has been saved. I wonder if he wrote anything else. If he did, it is gone now. Why did Grandfather give me those poems? Did he want me to find some meaning in them?
Does he not want me to go gentle? What does that even mean? Am I supposed to fight against authority? I might as well ask if he wants me to commit suicide, because that's what it would be. I wouldn't actually die, but if I tried to break the rules, they'd take away everything I value. A match, a family of my own, a good vocation. I would have nothing. I don't think Grandfather would want that for me. I can't figure it out. I've thought and thought about it and turned the words over in my head. I wish I could see the words again on paper and puzzle it out. For some reason, I feel like everything would be different if I could see them outside of myself, not only in my mind. I've realized one thing, though. Even though I've done the right thing, burned the words and tried to forget them, it doesn't work. These words won't go away. I'm relieved the minute I see Em sitting in the meal hall. She practically glows, and when she sees me, she lifts her arm to wave. The banquet went well then. She didn't panic. She made it through. She isn't dead. I hurry through the line, sliding into the seat next to her. So, I ask, even though I already know the answer to the question, how was the banquet? Her radiance shines on everyone in the room. Everyone at our table smiles. It was perfect. It's not Lon, then? I say, making a feeble joke. Lon was matched a few months ago. Em laughs. No, his name is Daylan. He's from Acadia Province. Acadia is one of the more heavily forested provinces to the east, miles away from our rolling hills and rivered valleys here in Oria. They have stone there, and sea, things we don't have much of here. And? I lean forward. So do the rest of our friends gathered at the table, all of us eager for details about the boy Em will marry. When he stood up, I thought, he can't be for me. He's tall, and he smiled at me right through the screen. He didn't even look a bit nervous. So he's handsome. Of course, Em smiles. And he didn't seem too disappointed in me either, thank goodness. How could he be? Em shines so radiantly today in her drab brown plain clothes that I imagine she was impossible to look away from last night in her yellow dress. So he's handsome, but what exactly does he look like? I'm embarrassed to hear a hint of jealousy in my voice, plain and clear. No one gathered around me to find out what Xander was like. There was no mystery because they already knew. Em is kind enough to ignore it. Actually, a little like Xander, she begins, and then she breaks off. I follow her gaze to where Xander stands a few feet away from us, holding his foilware on a tray and looking stricken. Did he hear the jealousy in my voice when Em described her match? What is wrong with me? I try to cover it up. We're talking about Em's match. He looks like you. Xander recovers quickly.
So he's unbelievably handsome.
He sits down next to me, but he doesn't look in my direction. I'm embarrassed. He definitely heard me. Of course, Em laughs. I don't know why I was so worried. She blushes a little, probably remembering the night in the music hall, and looks at Xander. It all turned out perfectly, the way you said it would. I wish they still let you print out a picture right away, I say. I want to see what he looks like. Em describes her match and tells us facts about Daylan that she learned from her microcard, but I'm too distracted to hear much. I worry that I've hurt Xander, and I want him to look at me or take my hand, but he does neither of those things. Em grabs my arm on our way out of the meal hall. Thank you so much for letting me borrow the compact. I think it helped to have something to hold on to, you know? I nod, agreeing. Kai gave it back to you this morning, didn't he? No. My heart drops. Where is my compact? Why doesn't Em have it? He didn't?
M's face pales. No, I say. Why does he have it?
I saw him on the air train after the match banquet. He was coming home late from work. I wanted you to have the compact back as soon as possible.
M takes a deep breath.
I knew you'd see Kai at hiking before you'd see me here, and I couldn't bring it straight back to your house because I was worried I'd be late for curfew.
Hiking was canceled this morning because of the weather.
It was?
Hiking is the one summer leisure activity that absolutely can't be done in inclement weather. Even swimming can be done in the indoor pool. M looks sick.
I should have realized that, but why didn't he find some way to get it to you? He knew how important it was. I made sure to tell him.
Good question. But I don't want this to ruin M's big moment. I don't want her to worry. I'm sure he gave it to Ada to give to my mother or father, I say, trying to sound lighthearted. Or he'll give it to me tomorrow at hiking. Don't worry, Xander says, looking directly at me now. He reaches out with his words to cross the small divides that keep coming between us. You can trust Kai.
Chapter 15. As I walk to the air train stop the next morning, things feel crisp, less weighted. The cool of the night accomplished what the rain yesterday did not. The air feels fresh, new. The sun blinking through the last of the clouds dares the birds to sing, and they do. It dares me to let the light in, and I do. Who wouldn't rage against the death of something so beautiful? I'm not the only one who feels it. At hiking, Kai finds me standing at the front of the group just as the officer begins speaking. Kai presses the compact into my hand. I feel the touch of his fingers, and I think he leaves them there, on mine, the smallest bit longer than necessary. I put the compact into my pocket. Why here, I wonder, still tingling. Why not give it to me at home? I'm glad I lent it to M, but I'm glad I have it back, too. The compact is the one link that I have left to my grandparents, and I vow never to let it out of my hands again. I think maybe Kai will wait for me to go in the woods, but he doesn't. When the officer blows the whistle, Kai takes off without a backward glance, and all at once my new bright feeling dissolves a little bit. You have your compact back, I remind myself. Something returned. Kai disappears completely into the trees ahead of me. Something lost. 3 minutes later, alone in the woods, I realize that Kai didn't give me back my compact. It's something else. I can tell the moment I pull it out of my pocket to make sure it looks all right. The object is similar, gold, a case you can snap open and shut, but it's definitely not my artifact. There are letters, N-E-S-W, and an arrow on the inside. It spins and spins and keeps pointing back to me. I didn't think that aberrations could have access to artifacts, but Kai obviously does. Did he give it to me on purpose? By accident? Should I try to give it back or wait until he says something to me? There are far too many secrets in these woods, I decide. I find myself smiling, polished bright again, ready for the sun.
Sir? Sir, Lon's fallen. We think he's injured.
The officer swears under his breath and looks at Kai and me, who are the only two up on the top of the hill except for this boy.
You two, stay up here and keep track of who comes when, all right?
The officer gives me the data pod, and before I can say anything, he disappears back into the forest with the boy. I think about telling Kai that we need to exchange artifacts. But before I say the words, something stops me. For some reason, I want to hold on to the mysterious spinning arrow in its gold case. Just for another day or two. What are you doing? I ask him instead. His hands move, making shapes and curves and lines in the grass that seem familiar. His blue eyes flash up to me.
I'm writing.
Of course. That's why the marks look familiar. He is writing in an old-fashioned, curved kind of writing, like the script on my compact.
I've seen samples of it before, but I don't know how to do it. No one does. All we can do is type. We could try to imitate the figures, but with what? We don't have any of the old tools. But I realize as I watch Kai that you can make your own tools. How did you learn to do this? I don't dare sit down next to him. Someone could come through the trees at any moment and need me to enter them in the data pod. So I stand as close as I dare. He grimaces, and I realize I am standing right in the middle of his words. I take a step back. Kai smiles but doesn't answer. He keeps on writing. This is the difference between us. I live to sort. He knows how to create. He can write words whenever he wants. He can swirl them in the grass, write them in the sand, carve them in a tree.
No one knows I can do this, Kai says. Now I have a secret of yours, and you have one of mine.
Just one? I say, thinking of the spinning arrow in the gold case. Kai smiles again. Some of the rain from last night pooled in the heavy, drooping petals of the wildflowers here. I dip my finger in the water and try to write along the slick green surface of one of the broad leaves. It feels difficult, awkward. My hands are used to tapping a screen, not to sweeping and swirling in controlled movements. I haven't held a paintbrush in years, not since my days in first school. Because the water is clear, I can't really see my letters, but I still know that they aren't formed correctly. Kai dips his finger into another droplet and writes a glistening C on the leaf. He makes the curve smoothly, gracefully. Will you teach me? I ask.
I'm not supposed to do that.
We're not supposed to be doing any of this, I remind him. Sounds drift up from the tangled trees and undergrowth below us. Someone is coming. I feel desperate to make him promise to teach me before anyone gets here and this moment vanishes. We're not supposed to know poems or writing or... I stop myself. I ask again, will you teach me? Kai doesn't answer. We're not alone anymore. Several people have reached the top, and from the wails I can hear through the forest, the officer and Lan's group are not far behind. I have to enter these names into the data pod, so I step away from Kai. I look back once at where he sits with his arms folded, looking out over the hills. It turns out that Lan will survive. Once the officer cures the melodrama accompanying the injury, they find that all Lan has is a slightly twisted ankle. Still, the officer warns us to take it slow on our way back to the bottom of the hill. I want to walk down with Kai, but he attaches himself to the officer and makes himself useful in getting Lan back down the mountain. I wonder why the officer bothered hauling Lan to the top at all until I hear him muttering something to Kai about making quota so they don't get after me. It surprises me, even though I know officers must report to people too. I walk with a girl named Livy, who is getting better and better at hiking as the days go on, and who acts enthusiastic about everything. She talks and talks, and I imagine Kai's hand making that sweeping curve of the sea for my name, and my heart beats faster. We're late getting back. I have to rush to the train bound for the borough, and Kai has to rush to the one that will take him to the city for work. I've given up on talking to him again today when I feel someone brush past me. At the same time, I hear a word so soft and quiet, I wonder if he said it up on the hill and the wind has just now carried it down to me. The word is yes. Chapter 16. I'm getting good at sea. When I arrive at hiking, I practically sprint to the top of the hill. After I check in with the officer, I hurry to my spot next to Kai. Before he can say anything, I pick up a stick and draw a sea right there in the mud next to him. What's next? I ask, and he laughs a little.
You know, you don't need me. You could teach yourself, he says. You could look at the letters on your scribe or your reader.
They're not the same, I tell him. They don't connect like yours do. I've seen your kind of writing before, but I don't know what it's called.
Cursive, he says softly. It's harder to read, but it's beautiful.
It's one of the old ways of writing.
That's what I want to learn. I don't want to copy the blocky, flat symbols of the letters we use now. I like the curves and sweeps of the ones Kai knows. Kai glances over at the officer, who stares fiercely into the trees as though he's daring someone else to fall and get hurt today. We don't have long before the others arrive.
What's next? I ask again.
A,
says Kai, showing me how to make a small letter A, embraced by a little swoop at the beginning and at the end, to attach it to what comes before and after.
Because it's the next letter in your name.
He reaches and takes hold of the stick above my hand. Up, around, down. Guiding, gentle, his hand presses against mine on the downward strokes, releases a little on the upward ones. I bite my lip in concentration, or maybe it's that I don't dare to breathe until the A is finished, which it is, all too soon. The letter looks perfect. I exhale, a little shakily. I want to look up at him, but instead I look down at our hands, right next to each other. In this light, his don't look so red. They look brown, strong, purposeful. Someone is coming through the trees. We both let go at the same time. Livy bursts into the clearing. She's never been third before, and she's almost beside herself with excitement. While she chatters at the officer, Kai and I stand up and casually trample what we've written into oblivion. Why am I learning to write the letters in my name first?
Because even if that's all you learn to write, you'll still have something,
he says, bending his head down to look at me, making sure I know what he's saying, what he's about to ask.
Was there anything else you wanted to learn to write instead?
I nod, and his eyes brighten with understanding.
The words from that paper,
he whispers, his eyes moving to Livy and the officer. Yes.
Do you still remember them?
I nod again.
Tell me a little every day,
he says,
and I'll remember it for you. Then there will be two of us who know.
Even though the time is short before Livy or the officer or someone else comes over to talk to us, I pause for a moment. If I tell Kai these words, I step into an even more dangerous place than I was before. It will put Kai in danger, and I will have to trust him. Can I do it? I look out at the view from the top of the hill. The sky does not have an answer for me. The dome of City Hall in the distance certainly doesn't. I remember thinking of the angels from the stories when I went to my match banquet. I don't see any angels, and they don't fly down on their cotton-soft wings to whisper in my ear. Can I trust this boy who writes in the earth? Someplace deep within me, is it my heart, or perhaps my soul, the mythical part of humans that the angels cared about, tells me that I can. I lean closer to Kai. Neither of us looks at the other. We both gaze straight ahead to make sure that no one will suspect anything if they glance our way. That's when I whisper the words to him, my heart so full it's about to burst because I'm saying them, really saying them out loud to another person. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Kai closes his eyes. When he opens them again, he slips something rough and papery into my hand.
Look at this for practice,
Kai says.
Destroy it when you're done.
I can hardly wait for second school and sorting to end so that I can look at what Kai has given me. I wait until I'm at home in the kitchen, eating my dinner alone because my work hours were long tonight. I hear my father and Bram playing a game on the port in the foyer, and I feel safe enough to reach into my pocket and pull out Kai's gift, a napkin. My first reaction is disappointment. Why this? It's a normal napkin, the kind we get from the meal halls at second school or the Arboretum or anywhere else. Brown and pulpy, smeared and used. I have the impulse to incinerate it right away. But when I open it up, there are words inside.
gorgeous words, cursive words. They were beautiful up on the green hill with the sound of wind in trees, and they are beautiful here in my gray and blue kitchen with the grumbling of the incinerator in the background. Dark, curling, swirling words curve across the brown paper. Where dampness has touched them, the words are slightly blurred. And it's not just words. He's drawn things, too. The surface is covered with lines and meaning. Not a picture, not a poem, not the lyrics to a song, although my sorting mind notices the pattern of all these things. But I can't classify them. This is nothing I have seen before. I realize that I don't even know what you would use to make marks like this. All of the words I practice are written in the air or traced in the dirt. There used to be tools for writing, but I don't know what they were. Even our paintbrushes in school were tethered to art screens, our pictures wiped away almost immediately after we finished them. Somehow, Kai must know a secret. Older than grandfather and his mother and people before them, how to make, create. Two lives, he's written. Two lives, I whisper to myself. The words hush and hang in the room, too soft for the port to hear above the other sounds in the house. Almost too soft for me to hear above my heart beating fast, faster than it ever has in the woods or on the tracker. I should go to my room, to the relative privacy of that little place with my bed, my window, my closet where plain clothes hang, dead and still. But I can't stop staring. It's hard, at first, for me to figure out what the picture is meant to be. But then I realize it's him, Kai, drawn twice, once on each side of the fold of the napkin. The line of his jaw gives it away, the shape of his eyes, the spareness and strength of his body. The space is left empty. His hands and the nothing they hold, though they are cupped, tipped skyward in both pictures. That's where the similarity between the pictures ends. In the first picture, he looks up at something in the sky, and he looks younger, his face is open. The figure there seems to think his hands might still be filled. In the second, he is older, his face narrower, and he looks down at the ground. Along the bottom, he has written, "Which one is the true one? I don't ask, they don't tell." Two lives. I think I understand this. His life before he came here and his life after. But what does he mean by the line of song or poetry or plea at the end?
Kasia?
My father calls from the doorway behind me. I scoop the napkin up with my foilware from dinner and take it all toward the incinerator and the recycling bin.
Yes?
Even if he sees it, it's a napkin, I tell myself, looking at the brown square on my tray. We incinerate them after every meal, and it's even the right kind of paper, not like the poem. The incineration tube won't register the difference. Kai is keeping you safe. I lift my eyes to my father.
It's a message for you on the port,
my father says. He doesn't look down at what I carry. He's focused on my face to see what I'm thinking. Maybe it's there that the real danger lies. I smile, try to look unconcerned. Is it from M? I slide my foilware into the recycling bin. Only the napkin left.
No,
my father says.
An official from the match department.
Oh. Just like that, I push the napkin down the incineration tube. I'll be right there, I say to my father. I feel the faintest hint of heat from the fire below as Kai's story burns, and I wonder if I will ever have the strength to hold on to something. Grandfather's poem, Kai's story, or if I will always be someone who destroys. Kai told you to destroy it, I tell myself. The man who wrote the poem is gone, but Kai is not. We have to keep it that way, keep him safe. I follow my father into the foyer. Bram glares at me on his way out of the foyer because this message has interrupted his game. Hoping to hide my nervousness, I give him a playful shove as I walk toward the port. The official on the screen is not one I've seen before. He's a cheerful, burly-looking man, not at all the cerebral, aesthetic type I imagine hovering over data screens in the match department.
Hello, Kasia,
he says. The collar of his white uniform seems tight around his neck, and he has laugh lines near his eyes. Hello. I want to look down and see if my hands are stained from the drawings, the words, but I keep my eyes on the official.
It's been over a month since your match.
Yes, sir.
Other matchees are arranging their first port-to-port communications now. I've spent the day putting those together for your peers. Of course, it would be rather ludicrous for you and Xander to have a formal port-to-port communication.
The official laughs cheerfully.
Don't you think?
I agree, sir.
The other officials on the matching committee and I decided it makes the most sense for the two of you to have an outing together instead. Supervised, of course, by an official, as are communications for the other matchees.
Of course. Out of the corner of my eye, I see my father standing in the door of his room, watching me, watching over me. I'm glad he's there. Even though the idea of spending time with Xander isn't at all new or scary, the idea of an official at our meeting feels a little strange. I hope it isn't the official from the green space, I think suddenly.
Excellent. You'll be eating outside of your home tomorrow night. Xander and the official assigned to your match will pick you up at your regular mealtime.
I'll be ready. The official signs off and the port beeps, indicating that we have another call waiting. We're popular this evening, I say to my father, glad of the distraction so we don't have to talk about my outing with Xander. My father already looks hopeful and hurries to stand next to me. It is my mother.
Kasia, can I speak with your father alone for a few minutes?
She asks me after we exchange hellos.
I don't have much time to talk tonight. I have some things I need to tell him.
She looks tired, and she still wears her uniform and insignia from work. Of course, I say. A knock sounds at the door, and I go to answer it. It's Xander.
We still have a few minutes before curfew, he says. Do you want to come talk on the steps with me?
Of course. I close the door behind me and go outside. The porch light shines bright above us, and we are in full view of the world, or at least the world of Maple Tree Burrow, as we sit down on the cement steps side by side. It feels good to be with Xander, in a different way than it feels good to be with Kai. Still, being with Kai, being with Xander, both things feel like standing in the light, different types of light, but neither feels dark.
It sounds like the two of us have an outing tomorrow night,
Xander says. The three of us, I say. And when he looks puzzled, I add, don't forget the official. Xander groans.
Right. How could I forget?
I wish we could go alone.
Me too.
Neither of us says anything for a moment. The wind sails along our street, ruffling the leaves on the maple trees. In the evening light, the leaves look silver gray. Their colors are gone, sucked away for now by the night. I think of the old disease of colorblindness, eliminated generations ago, and how the world might have looked to those people.
Do you ever daydream?
Xander asks me. All the time.
Did you ever daydream about your match? Before the banquet, I mean.
Sometimes, I say. I stop watching the play of the wind on the leaves of the maple tree and glance at Xander. I should have looked at Xander before I answered. It's too late now. Now I can tell by his eyes that my answer wasn't what he hoped, that by saying what I did, I closed a door instead of opening it. Perhaps Xander dreamed about me and wanted to know if I dreamed about him. Perhaps he has moments of uncertainty, as I do, and needs me to tell him that I feel sure about the match. This is the problem with being an uncommon match. We know each other too well. We feel the uncertainties in our touch, see them in each other's eyes. We don't work them out on our own, miles away from each other, the way the other matches do. They don't see the day-to-day. we do. Still, we are a match, and a deep understanding runs through us, even in the midst of a misunderstanding. Xander reaches for my hand, and I lace my fingers through his. This is the known. This is good. When I think about sitting on a porch with him on other nights in this life we've been given, I can picture it easily and happily. I want Xander to kiss me again. It's late evening, and there's even a new rose smell in the air, the way there was for our first kiss. I want him to kiss me again so that I know that what I feel for him is real. If it is more or less real than Kai's hand brushing mine on top of the little hill. Down the street, the last air train from the city sighs into the station. A few moments later, we see the figures of late workers hurrying down the sidewalks to get back to their houses by curfew. Xander stands up.
I'd better get back. See you tomorrow at school.
See you tomorrow, I say. He squeezes my hand and joins the others on the sidewalk, walking toward home. I don't go inside. I watch the figures and wave to a few of them. I know who I'm waiting for. Just when I think I won't see him, Kai pauses in front of my house. Almost before he stopped, I walk down the steps and over to talk to him.
I've been meaning to do this for the last few days,
Kai says. At first, I think he's reaching for my hand and my heart pauses. But then I see that he's holding out something. One of the brown paper envelopes that people who work in offices sometimes use. He must have gotten it from his father. I realize right away that my compact might be inside, so I reach to take the envelope from him. Our hands do not touch, and I find myself wishing that they had. What is wrong with me? I have your... I pause because I don't know what to call the case that holds the spinning arrow.
I know.
Kai smiles at me. The moon, hanging heavy and low in the sky near the horizon, is a harvest yellow slice like the melon we get to eat during the autumn holiday. The moon's light brightens Kai's face a little, but his smile does even more. It's inside. I gesture behind me at the steps and the lighted porch. If you want to wait down here, I can run in and get it.
That's all right,
Kai says.
It can wait. You can give it to me later.
His voice sounds quiet, almost shy.
I want you to have a chance to look at it.
I wonder what color his eyes are right now. Do they reflect the black of the night or the light of the moon? I move closer to try to see, but as I do, the almost curfew bell rings down the street and we both jump.
I'll see you tomorrow,
Kai says as he turns to leave. See you then. I have 5 more minutes before I have to be inside, so I stay out and do not move. I watch him all the way down the street, and then I look up at the moon in the sky and close my eyes. In my mind, I see the words I read earlier. Two lives. Ever since the day of the mistake with my match, I've never known which life is my true one. Even with the reassurances of the official that day in the green space, I think a part of me hasn't felt at peace. It was as though I saw for the first time that life could branch into different paths, take different directions. Back inside the house, I tip my compact out of the envelope and take Kai's artifact from its hiding place deep in the pocket of one of my extra sets of plainclothes. When I place them side by side, it's easy to tell the difference between the two golden circles. The surface of Kai's artifact is plain, scratched. The compact shines brighter, and its engraved letters catch my eye. On a whim, I pick up my artifact, twist the base, look inside. I know Kai saw me reading the poems in the forest. Did he also see me open the compact? What if Kai left a message for me? Nothing. I put the compact away on its shelf. I decide to keep the envelope, to put Kai's artifact inside before I put both in the pocket of my extra plainclothes for safekeeping. But before I do, I open the case and watch the spinning arrow. It settles on a point, but I still spin, wondering where to go. Chapter 17.
The climb is almost too easy. I slap branches out of the way, leap over rocks, and push through bushes. My feet have worn a path on this hill, and I know where to go and how to get there. I wish for a bigger challenge and for something harder to scale. I wish for the hill with its fallen trees and ungroomed forest. Right now, I think, if they put me on the hill, I could run straight up it. And when I reached the top, there would be a new view, and maybe, if he came with me and we stood there together, I would learn even more about Kai. I can't wait to see him and ask him about his story. Will he have more for me? I burst through the trees and grin at the officer.
Got some competition for your spot today,
he says as he records my climbing time on the datapod. What does he mean? I turn to see Kai. A girl sits next to him, bright golden hair streaming down her back. Livy. Kai laughs at something she says. He makes no move, no gesture to indicate that he wants me to come sit by him. He doesn't even look at me. Livy's taken my place. I take a step forward to get it back. Livy holds out a stick to Kai. He doesn't even hesitate. He takes hold of it right above her hand, and I see him helping her make swirling motions in the dirt. Is he teaching her to write? My one step forward becomes many steps back as I turn and walk away from it all. From the glint of sunlight on her hair, from their hands almost touching, writing letters in the dirt, from Kai's eyes looking away from me, from the spot in the sun with wind and whispered words that are supposed to be mine. How can I talk to Kai with her sitting right there? How can I learn how to write? How can I get more of his words? The answer is simple. I can't. Back down at the bottom of the hill, the officer gives us a speech.
Tomorrow will be different, he tells us. Stay at the Arboretum Air Train stop when you arrive and wait for me so I can lead you to the new site. We're finished with this hill.
Finally, Kai says behind me in a voice so quiet only I can hear.
I was beginning to feel like Sisyphus.
I don't know who Sisyphus is. I want to turn around and ask Kai, but I don't. He taught Livy to write. Is he telling her his story too? Did I trick myself into thinking I was special to him? Perhaps many girls know Kai's story and have fallen for the gift of writing their names. Even as I think these things, I know they are wrong, but I can't clear my mind of the sight of his hand guiding hers. The officer blows his whistle to dismiss us. I walk away, staying slightly separate from everyone else. I've walked a few steps when I hear Kai behind me.
Anything you want to tell me?
He asks softly. I know what he's asking. He wants to hear more of the poem. I shake my head no, turn my face away. He didn't have any words for me. Why should I give him any of mine? I wish my mother weren't gone. The timing of this trip is strange. Summer is the busiest season at the Arboretum, so many plants to tend. And I miss her for selfish reasons, too. How am I supposed to get ready for my first official outing with Xander without her? I put on a clean pair of plain clothes, wishing that I still had the green dress. If I did, I would wear it again to remind both Xander and me of what everything was like a month ago. When I come out into the foyer, my father and my brother wait for me.
You look beautiful,
my father says, cheerfully. He's not worried about this outing. It's Xander, after all.
You look all right, Bram says.
Thanks, I tell him, rolling my eyes. Bram says this every time I go somewhere. Even on the night of the match banquet, he said the same thing. I like to think he said it with more sincerity, though.
Your mother's going to try to call tonight. She wants to hear all about the evening,
my father says. I hope she can. The idea of talking with my mother comforts me. The dinner chime sounds in the kitchen.
Time to eat,
my father says, putting his arm around me.
Would you rather we waited here with you or got out of the way?
Bram is already halfway to the kitchen. I smile at my father.
You should go eat with Bram. I'll be fine. My father gives me a kiss on the cheek.
I'll be back as soon as the doorbell rings.
He's a little wary about the official, too. I imagine my father coming to the door and saying politely,
I'm sorry, sir. Kasia won't be able to go tonight.
I imagine him smiling at Xander so that Xander knows he's not the one my father's worried about. And then I picture my father closing the door gently but firmly and keeping me safe inside this house. Inside these walls where I have been safe for so long. But this house isn't safe anymore, I remind myself. This house is where I first saw Kai's face on a microcard, where they searched my father. Is there a safe place anywhere in this borough, in this city, this province, this world? I resist the urge to repeat the words of Kai's story to myself while I wait. He is already in my mind far too much, and I don't want him coming along tonight. The doorbell rings, Xander, and the official. I don't think I'm ready to do this, and I don't know why. Or rather, I do know why, but I can't look at it too closely right now, or I know it will change everything. Everything. Outside the door, Xander waits for me. It strikes me that this symbolizes what is wrong here. No one can ever really come in, and when